Seattle Kitchen Show. Thank you for joining us. I'm Tom Douglas.
And I'm Terry Rotrero, the chef in the house.
We have a very excited audience that's just waiting for a breakfast sandwich from the Dahlia Bakery. We have a large show for you today, 2 hours, in case you're wondering how long we're going to be here. You can always podcast us also. On the show today, Thanksgiving is upon us. We're going to take a look at some of our favorite traditions. I brought a little book to read that we read at our Thanksgiving table every year. Megan and John, editors of the newest edition of Joy of Cooking, are going to join us on the mic. And Brendan McGill is going to be here to talk about his new downtown restaurant, Bartaglio. He's going to talk Roman-style pizza.
Yeah, I'm curious about that.
So excited about that. It seems to be the hot now pizza.
Yeah.
Because I know Renee Erickson just opened one at the Spheres over down here at 6th and Lenora called Wilmont's Ghost. And I've had it over there. It's just very different in style. So.
When I think Roman pizza, I think the distance between here and Chicago. The distance between your pizza.
No, that's roaming pizza. Anyway, I'm Tom Douglas. I own several restaurants here in downtown Seattle. And I am also good buddies with this dude standing next to me.
Terry Rotrero, the chef in hat, owner of Luc in Madison Valley, and Lule downtown Seattle at the bottom of the Sheraton Grand.
Yeah, lots of things going on. As I said before, you know, we're limiting our pie sales at the Dahlia Bakery this year.
So shame.
If you are going to order, you should order now. We have a limited amount because we are trying to get to a better life balance in our baking team. And having people stay up 3 nights in a row is not how you get there. So we're just we decided to limit ourselves, and so that will be that. If you want a pie from the Dahlia Bakery, just go to dahliabakery.com.
And I wish the whole world would think that way, Tom Douglas. That's actually a great way to think.
Well, you know,
a great thing can only come in so many portions.
The holidays are supposed to be fun for everyone, right?
Exactly.
So that's all I'm saying. And it is fun to make a bunch, like to be busy, but it's not so fun 3 nights in a row when you haven't slept. Okay, Ordinary to Extraordinary, Chef. It's our holiday edition. And there are some fun food-related holidays falling in front of us. You know what that is?
Yes. Yes.
Oh.
Yes. Holidays? Yes, I do know what that is.
Thanksgiving. But there's also some National Food Days coming. So there's National Cashew Day. What's your favorite thing to do with cashews? Or do you want me to tell you what I do?
I probably would use them in a salad. That would be my favorite way to use them. Roasted, salted, and then crunched, and then tossed into a salad. Because I like the texture of cashew. It's a very beautiful, I think it's a nice, what is it, a legume? Or it's just a nut?
I don't know.
It's a nut.
How am I supposed
cashew
to know?
Nuts.
That's why we have the fabulous Abigail to look
that's
it up
right.
for us.
That's right. She's all Dr. Abigail.
Yeah,
what's
so
the answer?
I like to take them. I'll make a butter, and I'll put curry powder in it, maybe a little garlic, maybe a little fresh herb like rosemary or thyme. And then I'll cook the cashews in the butter and then bake them until they're golden brown.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have curry butter cashews for your spinach salad or for
nice.
On top of another curry for a better flavor or something like that. So that, to me, is my favorite
way to do
cashews.
That would be good with a pork belly salad.
Mm. All right. National Espresso Day is coming up.
Yeah, well.
I like an espresso right before I go to bed. Doesn't that seem weird?
I like an espresso after dinner.
Yeah.
And I like a nice little crema on top, and I want it to be a short shot.
Short shot.
And that's the way I like my espresso.
For some reason, coffee makes me sleepy.
But I can tell you one thing. It does not stop me from sleeping, and I think that's because we use all day correctly.
When I have espresso at dinner, I like it as dessert, and I like it on top of my vanilla ice cream, the affogato.
Affogato.
Yeah.
Mm. That's a great way use espresso.
All right. It's Eat a Cranberry Day during this holiday season.
Eat a cranberry day.
Do you do anything besides make a cranberry relish for Thanksgiving? Do you do anything with cranberries?
I've done cranberry sauce, you know, to go with a fish. For example, we have sturgeon right now we're featuring. If you take a piece of sturgeon and you saute it nicely, to take a cranberry and make like a beurre blanc but with cranberry, so sliced shallots, whole cranberry, white wine, reduced down, little dash of cream, and then finish with butter and blend the whole thing up.
Mm-hmm.
So you end up with this unctuous sauce, and you put that right around your sturgeon, and it makes a very nice little sauce.
I could never get over the color when I made a cranberry beurre blanc.
Well, it's pink.
Yeah, it is definitely pink.
Yeah, it's very pink. You don't get over that?
For some reason, it bothers me. I do like to mix cranberries in with my apples when I make a cranberry apple pie. I like a little, because they're so tart. And it to me, it sweetens up the apples. It's Doctor Who Day, Abigail. What are you talking about there? Get on that microphone, young woman.
Have you not seen Doctor Who?
I have not seen Doctor Who. Is that like a new self-help person?
It's not. It's the sci-fi series. It's been going on forever.
Yeah, it's been going on since the late 70s.
I'm a young man. I don't know what you're talking about.
You always give me a hard time for not having seen things.
Okay, so what's Doctor Who, and why is it Doctor Who Day?
Doctor Who, it first aired on November 21st, when this episode is going to air, however many years ago, over 50 years ago, actually, because I remember their 50th anniversary happened, and one of the doctors, the 11th doctor, they regenerate, and they get new taste buds and everything.
Uh-huh.
So
they get new taste buds?
Yeah, they get new taste buds. So he came out of his little TARDIS, which is a time machine, and he tried to find something that he'd like to eat, and the thing he landed on was fish fingers and custard, which sounds...
Doctor Who is messed up.
Not great, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So how would you make that extraordinary?
Fish fingers.
Fish fingers.
Mm-hmm. It's a
like,
trap.
Are they? Do you eat them together? Like, do you dip the fingers in the custard?
Yeah, he dips the fish fingers in the custard.
Okay, so the custard is obviously a gelatinized aioli, right?
Right.
Right, and the fish fingers, I think they went to the Blue North cod... boat.
I was going to say cod or pollack.
Delicious Alaska cod and made fish fingers out of them, like Mrs. Paul's did. You don't even know who Mrs. Paul is, do you?
No.
You know who I thought Who Day was? I thought it was the lead singer of Hootie and the Blowfish.
Me too.
I've never actually had a fish finger, so how would you make that extraordinary?
So you simply take the fish, cut it into a finger shape, and then dredge it in flour, dredge it in egg wash, dredge it in breadcrumbs. Let it sit for 5 minutes and deep fry.
Mm,
and that's your fish finger. You can do the same thing with chicken fingers, right? Steak fingers.
Now, that's if you want to fry those. Otherwise, you can just plain old without battering it. Just throw it in a little bit of olive oil in a pan and have the resulted of same idea, except not fried.
All right. Well, give that a try, Doctor Who fans.
I'm going to have to see this show. Who knew? Up next, we're going to reminisce about our favorite Thanksgiving traditions and stories. I have a little reading, which I will try to get through without getting all teary, because this is the one that we read every year at our Thanksgiving table. Each person takes a page as we pass it around and all the food gets cold. On Cairo Radio, 97.3 FM. We are back. It's the Seattle Kitchen Show. The sandwiches just arrived. Everyone is happy. So Chef Terry and I wanted to share a few of our traditions at our table for Thanksgiving. Happy Thanksgiving, everyone out there.
Yeah, happy Thanksgiving. I mean, it's one of my favorite holiday. I think it is the best holiday because there is no gift, there is no, you know, none of this heavy, like have to do things kind of thing. You're just showing up. It's dinner, and if you're lucky, you participate in making some of it, some side dishes or some peeling of something, and you just have a great time, and I just think it's fantastic.
Well, I have a book that it's called The Greatest Table. It was written with conjunction with Share Our Strength. With you and I, you and I both did many events with Share Our Strength's team to fight against hunger. And Michael Rosen wrote this book. It's a Share Our Strength book. I don't know if it's still in circulation.
In print.
I guess I would doubt it. But it's a 12-foot-long accordion book, and what we do at our table is I'll read the first page, and then we pass it around to each of the kids to read a page that could read. And by the end, you get kind of teary because it's, at least I do, I'm emotional. And, you know, I've gotten more emotional as I've gotten older. You get kind of teary because it's just there's always room at the table. So here it goes. You are invited to the greatest table. The greatest table isn't set inside a single home. Oh, no. It spans the continents, and no one eats alone. The table in your dining room, a picnic bench, a tray, a party tent, your beach blanket, a small sidewalk cafe. A banquet hall, breakfast in bed, a lunch box, takeout sack, the circle at a campfire roast, or any tea time snack. Each one is just another leaf in one uncommon table, where all the guests have cooked or baked or brought what they are able. Where all of us can help ourselves and all of us are fed and no one has been turned away with just a crust of bread. The greatest table, like a tree, is growing leaf by leaf. and widening its canopy to welcome more beneath. Its tablecloth is flowering and covers all of our knees. Its branches bend with every food from pineapples to peas. Who hasn't eaten? Join us here. Pull up another chair. We'll all scoot over. Make more room. There's always some to spare. Baskets mound with crusty breads. There's soup in simmering pots. And bushels brim year-round with fruit. Now pears. Now apricots. And always in the company, there's someone we can toast. An elder. An infant. Long-lost friend. An honored guest. The host. The table talk is musical with every language shared. In every face, the thankfulness is more than any prayer. The next time you sit down to eat, the greatest table's set, connecting you with each of us who hasn't eaten yet. So if you're hungry, join us here. Pull up another chair. We'll all scoot over, make more room. There's always some to spare.
Sounds just
so like- that's a book called The Greatest Table. By Michael J. Rosen, and a different artist did each page. It's super cool. So, Chef, do you have any?
We play this little game in our house when we have dinner, not just on Thanksgiving, but usually every time we have dinner, but Thanksgiving is definitely in the same room. We play what's called the pig, which is what you are proud of for the day and what you're inspired by. And what you're
so
great,
proud being the P, inspired by.
And then what you're grateful for.
Grateful for. Okay.
So we go around the table and everybody gives their pig.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a great way to take a few minutes to breathe and to actually just reflect on how fortunate we are because we live in the best country in the world, as far as I'm concerned. And we have nothing that we can actually be complaining about when we're sitting around the table and have some food. Because many people don't.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the thing you have to remember. Every time you sit down around the table, well, some people don't have that fortune. So you want to try to either inspire them to join or, you know, be grateful that you actually can sit down and have a meal.
So exactly.
When I was a kid, we used to always do that in our house. It was always, you would show up, anybody would show up. It was always like, oh, just stay for dinner. I mean, it wasn't fancy, but it was dinner. Mm-hmm. You know, it'd be like a big boiling pot of water and make some pasta or some big omelette with mushroom or whatever and cheese. Something very, you know, not expensive, but something that would be on the table with a big salad. Then you'll have that and you'd be a joiner to the table. And I think it's something that, unfortunately, in a city dwelling kind of situation, in the urban setting that we have, it is something that's missing a lot. Huh. You know, it's a little bit harder to do. You don't really have people coming to your door, and if they do, you're going to call the cops.
No, but you do have. Like, I hear our coworkers all the time inviting each other to Thanksgiving dinner. They just say, you got a place to go?
Right.
We're cooking. Come on over. And I think that happens in urban dwellings as well as anywhere. This last weekend, I flew to into Philadelphia, but my mom lives about 45 minutes south in Newark, Delaware. And maybe 7 or 8 years ago, we invited her out, and she accepted Thanksgiving dinner at our house. And during the middle of dinner, I looked over, and there were big tears in her eyes. And she was so sad not to be home at her own. Because it was the first time she hadn't made Thanksgiving dinner in her life as a mom. She was super sad. And there's nothing I could do about it. It is what it is, right?
Yeah.
So instead, some of the family has been going back the week before Thanksgiving, because we all have our own Thanksgiving traditions.
Sure.
Been going back the week before Thanksgiving and making her Thanksgiving dinner in her house because she's not capable anymore. And especially now, she fell and broke a rib a couple of days ago, so she was just kind of sitting in her chair enjoying the show. But 6 of my 7 siblings were back there. We all made Thanksgiving dinner this last weekend. And super fun. I hadn't had Thanksgiving in her house. I've been here 42 years now in Seattle. I don't think I've had Thanksgiving in her house in 35 or 38 years.
Wow.
So it brought back a lot of memories. You know, she's of the era. She's 90. The good china only comes out for, and the good silver, right, only comes out for these kind of occasions. Whereas I use it every day. I don't care. If
yeah,
it breaks,
too.
It breaks, right? So, but no, for hers is in the buffet, and it comes out for these kind of occasions. And it was fun to see all the old pots that went around the table. And I always remember my dad at the head of the Thanksgiving table, the turkey would come out on a big pewter platter that my grandma had hammered, and then he would, you know, he wasn't even Catholic, and he would say grace, which, no, this is what he did. First, he went around the table. You had to pass your plate to him, and he would carve dark or light, and then you got put on everything on your plate, whether you liked it or not, like pickled beets making me want to vomit, but I had to have them, which is why the dog had purple lips. So anyway, we do this whole process. There's 20 of us sitting at the table, or better. Do the whole process, one by one. It's like 20 minutes, and you're sitting there looking at the steamy mashed potatoes with the butter melting on top. It's like, oh, my God, just let me eat. And but instead, now he gets all done, and now he wants to do a prayer. And I just look at him. It's like, you don't even go to church. And you're going to make me wait to eat this, whatever. Anyway, so we just said the prayer, and then we all got to dig in, and I got to feed the dog my beets.
The dog's never been the same ever since.
No, he's very regular, and I got busted because he had purple lips.
Yeah.
So, whatever. Anyway, that's some of our Thanksgiving traditions. I hope that you enjoy yours this year. It is a special time, and don't forget, don't let the recipe box die with you, right? Pass on some of these recipes and Thanksgiving traditions, even if they're old-fashioned, pass them on to your kids and to your family.
The memorabilia.
Up next, we have the stewards of the Joy of Cooking, Irma Rombauer's great-great-grandson, to talk about the new edition of Joy of Cooking on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. Welcome back. It's the Seattle Kitchen Show. I'm Tom Douglas.
And I'm Terry Rothschild, the chef in the hat.
We are so excited to have the authors or the stewards or however you want to describe yourself. I've often called you conspirators of the new Joy of Cooking, the updated Joy of Cooking cookbook. And we're going to do a whole series on this book because it's Terry's and my favorite, wouldn't you say?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. As an American cookbook, I am on it for sure.
Exactly.
My wife introduced me to it, and it's a great, great book.
So this week we're going to delve into the history. It's got quite the history. We're going to go in future weeks into all the 600 new recipes that have been added to the book, maybe some of the ones that have been taken out. We're going to do a whole show on baking, and we're going to do a whole show on beginner cooks and how do they approach the book, and how does a book make them more successful in that process and turn the corner on loving to cook. But first, Megan Scott, John Becker, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
And let's talk about the history of the Joy of Cooking and how you guys got, who are you, where'd you come from, and how you got this incredible opportunity to affect one of America's greatest cookbooks.
Well, it's straight-up nepotism. Fourth generation of the family to take up the task of revising Joy of Cooking.
Nice.
My great-grandmother, Irma, self-published the book in 1931. This is, you know, her husband passed away. She took half of her life savings and just got a wild hair and decided that she had... despite not really having any renown in the kitchen or professional training, that she was going to publish this cookbook, and
during the Great Depression, is kind of what blows my mind, is that she even had that idea mm-hmm. and felt like it could work, because it seems so unlikely that it would be successful. Mm-hmm. But she, what Irma was bringing to the table was, at the time, a lot of cookbooks were very dry, kind of home economics focused cookbooks, and she had a really incredible sense of humor. She was very witty, and she really injected that into the first edition of Joy. And I think her readers saw that, and it was just it was completely new at the time to mm-hmm. do something like that. It was a very personal cookbook, and I think that sense of Irma being kind of your friend in the kitchen rather than a teacher who was, you know, standing at a podium and telling you what to do really resonated with a lot of people. Mm-hmm.
I had the biggest crush on my high school home ec teacher, I just got to say. I think I would have liked Irma. That's sick.
I think I think it is the same trait that Julia Child brought to the TV cooking shows. I think that was the same kind of affection that people had for her.
Yes.
Because she was so witty and funny and... But
and
yet
real.
Very serious about her cooking.
Yes.
You know, and that was what I think was so attractive.
So the first one came out. So you're related, and are you? You're not related.
We're just married. John and I are married.
Oh, you guys are married.
Yeah. Just married.
I like just married.
You are married.
You just got married?
1931, the first book comes out. How long did it take it, The Joy of Cooking, to become a success, in quotes? Because it was the Depression, right?
Sure. So 5 years later, Irma had been doing recipe testing and research, and she finally got a contract with Bob's Merrill, a big publisher in the Midwest. It's no longer. The 1936 edition added, the first edition was fairly modest. We're talking like maybe 400, 500 recipes max. Mm-hmm. The second edition, 2,500 recipes were in the book. And, just a really big expansion of her coverage.
And that edition was also when the Joy's famous recipe writing format was invented. So Irma created, we call it the action method, mm-hmm. of writing recipes, where the ingredients and the instructions are intermingled rather than having an ingredient list at the top of the recipe and then having the instructions below. And she did that to save space, but it's also, we love it because it's kind of a narrative recipe format. So you can just read through the recipe almost like a story as you're in the kitchen. So it's can be a little bit easier to follow.
That's the way all the recipe used to be written. In the older days, they used to just write, egg, put it in the bowl, and then you had to you had to read the. This is actually why you have to read the entire recipe before you start, so you actually know where you're going.
Because what ingredients you need.
Yeah, because you have no idea.
That is the one prerequisite, especially for grocery lists. You have to read through the whole recipe. But luckily, the ingredients are bolded, so it's kind of easy to pick out.
So that's 1936. So when was the first revision that wasn't Irma's?
Marion Rombauer Becker, her daughter, helped on the 1951 edition. In fact, she had this really, she was kind of like the bookworm, the researcher, the nerd, if you will. And so she first took a stab at the bread chapter in the 1951 edition. It was vastly improved. Then when Irma passed away in 1962, that's when Marion really... that's when she took it over, and she really had a different vision than Irma did. You know, Irma was very conversational, but those early editions are fantastic, but it was really just a big collection of recipes. Mm-hmm. Whereas Marion wanted to turn it into the American version of the La Russe Gastronomie.
Yeah, an encyclopedia.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, she really wanted to have it to try to make Joy into a kitchen resource, just somewhere where you could turn if you had a question, regardless of whether or not it's like how to, just whatever life throws at you. She wanted to be able to give people guidance on how to cook it, whether it's a possum or a croissant.
A possum or croissant.
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe both of them together.
Oh, right? Yeah. It's a new filling. It's good.
You know, there was a big to-do hubbub about when Maria Guarnicelli, who I don't know who hired her to edit that book. Scribner did.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah.
So they bought the rights to the book then? Is that how Scribner got it? They bought the publisher?
We've always had like kind of a weird relationship dating back to Irma. Irma basically, she was, I guess you could call it taken advantage of by Bob's Merrill, but basically, it's kind of a 50-50 ownership deal. Mm-hmm. My father, Ethan, spent... like decades, basically, a decade and change, wrangling with the publisher at the time, which was Macmillan. Eventually, Simon & Schuster / Scribner was interested in kind of taking over their stake in the book. And, Ethan was advised by his agent to, hey, this Maria's a high-powered, well-connected editor.
Yeah, and she was very influential at the time.
Yeah, and extremely smart and, just definitely well-qualified. But of course, like you were saying, you apparently have a lot of friends that worked on the 97. Mm-hmm. And, all really good writers, experts in their fields were brought in to kind of, not just revise, but actually rewrite entire sections of the book. And it's actually, that's a book, that's the edition I took to college. And, it's really the first time I got to know Joy of Cooking, on my own, was a 97 edition. And so I'm really I do have a love for that edition, but a lot of people felt like the voice had been lost.
Just different. Yeah, I thought the voice, because there was, how many different teams were doing that project?
There were over 100 contributors on that edition.
Exactly.
It was a massive undertaking.
It felt disjointed in a way to me. So.
Well, and the manuscript ended up being gigantic, and so at the end they really had to cut it down so it would actually fit in one volume that people would want to carry around. In fact, like all the canning chapters went away, frozen desserts went away, cocktails.
I know, it's tragedy.
That's horrible.
I guess cocktails were kind of at a low ebb in their popularity at the time, but still, you know, it's...
Yeah, craft beer was coming on, and certainly wine, but...
Yeah.
But anyway, so yeah, the next edition, the 2006 edition, so there is one that intervened between then and now. That was kind of our attempt to take back joy to where it, you know, to the 1975 edition, to like, you know, the classic, you know, coverage, you know, all-encompassing coverage that we had, while retaining some of the awesome recipes that were added in the 97 edition. And I feel like, you know, so the 97 was kind of a scorched earth rewrite. That's how I like to describe it. And then the 2006 was an attempt to kind of go back to where you know, to the greatness that was. But with this new edition, we wanted to just revise it in the way that Marianne and Irma were doing, just like nice, incremental, you know, just make it better. Just make it more comprehensive, more complete, more useful.
I think you said a word earlier, just giving people confidence in the kitchen is really, especially for young new cooks or even new cooks of any age, is really a way to get them hooked.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Many people talk about wanting to cook, but many of them are scared.
Yes.
Because they look at it under something very foreign as opposed to something that's so friendly and so cool. I mean, you just get in the kitchen, have fun.
I know.
All right.
That's how we feel.
Thanks, Megan. Thank you, John. They are the writers of the new edition of Joy of Cooking. We're going to continue this series for the next 3 weeks, including the new recipe day, a baking day, and a beginner cook day. So watch for that upcoming in the Seattle Kitchen shows. Up next, we talked about Thanksgiving sides last week, and apparently we got a lot of questions about that. So we're going to revisit Thanksgiving sides right here on Cairo Radio, 97.3 FM. Welcome back. It's the Seattle Kitchen Show. We're here at the Hot Stove Society enjoying ourselves as usual. It's my favorite 2 hours of the week. I get to hang out with my buddy Chef Terry and our production assistant. You're not an assistant anymore. You're running the show today.
Well, Tina's out of town, so I'm Tina now.
Good.
I'm Abigail, not based, however.
Abigail is here. And you are going to you've been on our Facebook page. And last week we did a bunch of little chit-chat about sides for Thanksgiving, and then there were more questions after that. So why don't we jump into some of those?
Yeah, and you can follow us on Seattle Kitchen on Facebook in order to join the discussion at any point. We always want questions. So this first one's from Melissa Henry, and she wants to know, what is a great signature Thanksgiving cocktail to serve?
Signature.
Well, for me, it would be champagne. That's always been my tradition. I know this is not Thanksgiving, maybe.
It's not a cocktail yet.
It's my cocktail. I mean, my cocktail is champagne. It's just champagne. You know, a good meal starts with a glass of champagne. But you could do a champagne cocktail. I could take those cranberries that we were talking about earlier and just dehydrate them a day before in the oven, wrapped in sugar, and you'd have a wonderful little popping cranberry, sweet cranberry to put into your champagne.
Uh-huh.
And that would be a nice little, because the flavor of cranberry is such a nice little tart flavor, then it would go well with your champagne.
I would make something with Amaro. So my wife loves to make Amaro cocktails of some sort. So Amaro is a bitter, how would you describe it? It's a bitter.
It's like a root bitter.
Yeah, it's
sweet.
Yeah, herbaceous kind of alcohol drink. And I would mix that with maybe a little Amontillado sherry, which is dry. The Amaro, I would not use an overly sweet one, like, for example, Campari or Aperol. To me, they're too sweet for this kind of particular drink. And then maybe a little vodka or gin or something like that, those three ingredients, and do a twist of orange around the lip, the rim of the glass. What was that look for?
Oh, I just thought that sounded good.
Yeah. And I thought maybe you were making fun of me for not knowing Doctor Who again. around the rim of the glass, and... strain it in there over, you know, stir it with ice, strain it over top, and you have a beautiful Thanksgiving starter.
Yeah, and then put some custard and fish fingers in that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. All right, the next question is from Patty Bornheimer. We talked a little bit about stuffing already last week, but she wants to know, she always loves a really moist stuffing and dressing, but it either ends up mushy or too dry. What do you suggest for Patty?
Well, mushy would probably be because it's not baked enough. That'd be my guess. So you bake it a little bit longer, and you'll have a soft, slightly moist stuffing, but that won't be mushy. The mushiness usually comes too much soakiness or not enough baking. That's how you end up with mushy bread, basically. So,
well, too much soakiness. You mean she's put too much water or stock on the bread stuffing.
Right,
yeah.
Right. So just take it easy on the liquids on your bread, so it doesn't become such a chore to dry it up, because you don't want to dry it up so dry that you can't eat it, but you want to make sure that you get rid of some of that mushiness and moisture. You don't want to create that. So,
yeah, you want to get rid of. I like a good crusty dressing.
Yeah, me too.
So I put plenty of stock on. If you want a mushy dressing, just put it inside the turkey, and it comes out like almost like soup. I hate it,
yeah,
personally. But if you want a nice oven roasted one, so that the center is a little custardy, but the outside is all crispy and caramelized, that to me is the perfect dressing. And that's what I make for Thanksgiving, the perfect dressing.
What do you put in there?
I use rustic bread. I use the juice from the rehydrated porcini mushrooms, celery, onions, lots of olive oil, lots of butter, toasted nuts. I mean, all
those,
sorts
those
of
Those dried mushrooms you've been keeping in your cupboard for the last 6 years, time to put them in the bucket of water,
yeah,
and use that for flavoring.
Mm-hmm. Just strain out a little bit. Sometimes there's a little grit in there, so strain that out. But
yeah.
But and if you think that you're going to use water in your stuffing, you should really just go out for dinner. Make some stock from the turkey wings and the giblets and the neck, and just make a little stock. If you want it to be even better, and you only have canned stock at home, or if you do have canned stock, start brown off your turkey gizzards and the neck and the wing bits and things like that. And then put canned stock over top. So you start with instead of water, you start with a little bit of stock. Okay.
Well, now I'm hungry. The next question is from Sheila Lipinski. She says, I was just reading an article on traditional Southern-style dishes for Thanksgiving. What would be a Pacific Northwest-inspired side dish?
Well, I would use cranberry. I mean, sorry. We always talk about cranberry. You know, huckleberries is also a very high-pride berry from the Northwest that I think is very typical of the area, and also has a fabulous flavor, savory flavor. I mean, fresh thyme or tarragon and a huckleberry made into a nice little sauce or chutney is absolutely delicious. Mm-hmm. It's a great garnish. It's a nice little change. It's not your typical cranberry. Unfortunately, I find out there all the time that most people buy their cranberry sauce. I'm like, oh, such a shame. It's so easy to make.
Well, and they're grown here, too. A lot of people don't realize that there's tons and tons of cranberries grown on the Northwest Coast over in the bogs along southern Oregon and southern Washington. So, but dried huckleberries would be nice in your stuffing, too.
Yeah.
You don't want to put fresh ones in because your stuffing's going to come out purple and gross. But if you use dried ones that haven't been soaked in sugar before they're dried, just dried huckleberries, it makes a nice little tart bite in your dressing.
This one is from Emily Sakuma, MVP, on our Facebook page. And she says, I'm trying to use up a bottle of pomegranate molasses that has been in my fridge for a year. Any ideas?
Sure.
You should have called the show earlier.
take some butter, melt it in a pan with fresh herbs and garlic, and then about 50-50 pomegranate molasses to the butter. And then baste your turkey with that throughout its roasting process. Mm. You know, pomegranate molasses is super tart, so the butter's actually going to sweeten it up a little bit. And then just baste it away, and it'll get nice and golden brown, and the herbs will stick on because of the molasses is sticky. So unlike when you just put, like, a compound butter on top of your turkey, you know how sometimes people rub their turkey with butter? That just melts off, essentially. So this will actually stick onto the turkey. And if you're afraid of getting it too dark, just cook your turkey halfway and then start the basting process. And then you don't have to worry about it getting over-caramelized.
And
if it does start to get over-caramelized, tent it with a piece of aluminum foil.
And or if you want, you can take a little bit of that juice and mix it with a little Dijon mustard, half olive oil, half vegetable oil, safflower oil. Make a wonderful little dressing.
Mm.
Use that on the side of your stuffing.
Ooh. That'd
if you have a stuffing and you make a nice little dressing next to it. I personally like when you mix, you know, something that's kind of like rich and heavy and with something that's bright. So there you go.
Nice. Last question. This is from Jen Spilgren, and she wants to know, any good way to incorporate mushrooms? My family always put chanterelles in the gravy, but what else do you suggest?
Anywhere, anywhere, anytime.
Just roast them whole
and serve them as a side dish. Use them as an appetizer. Stuff them with a little crab meat mix that maybe you would make a crab cake out of, but stuff them in your mushrooms instead. But I like to roast them first and then do my stuffing into the mushroom top, right? They're too watery if you just use them raw, stuff them, and then try to bake them. So that's what I would do.
Saute them ahead of time. You can use them anywhere you want. You can use them in your mashed potato, as far as I'm concerned. That would be delicious.
Well, thank you, Chef. Thanks for thanks for your approval. Up next, it's leftover time. It's after Thanksgiving, and it's time for leftovers. What are we going to do? On Cairo Radio, 97.3 FM. And we're back. It's the Seattle Kitchen Show. It's magically post-Thanksgiving. Through the power of radio, I'm Tom Douglas.
I'm Terry Rutter.
I'm
the chef in a hat.
I'm so tired. I'm so sick of turkey.
I think I'm going to go take a nap.
These are all things that I've heard after Thanksgiving.
I have a nice little Armagnac, also known as brandy prune.
Mm-hmm. Mm. For me, I never get sick of Thanksgiving leftovers. Matter of fact, I start them on the night of Thanksgiving because usually you eat like 4 or 5 o'clock.
And you're hungry by the time.
I know. So then I have a hot turkey sandwich before I go to bed with some stuffing. Why not?
Yeah.
Oh, look who's joined us.
Guys.
Brittany Bartleben is here. She's going to join us in a few for the Baker's Corner. And for the Food for Thought Tasty Trivia Challenge, which we always finish our show with.
Yeah, and she usually is pretty strong, so
we'll see.
Oh, like my knees are shaking, man.
Tom looks like he's out for blood.
Yeah, I'm out for blood today. Okay, leftovers, folks. You've got some turkey. You've got some stuffing. I think it's a little bit more difficult, say, on the green beans, but, you know, those heartier things like the sweet potatoes, the mashed potatoes. I'll start. My favorite leftover is mashed potatoes made into potato pancakes. I just add some cheese and the sour cream and make potato pancakes, and then I put hot gravy on top of my mashed potatoes. Mm. Pan brown them until they're dark.
That is exactly what I do with a mashed potato the morning after.
Yeah, exactly.
Breakfast, poached egg right on top. Mm.
But I already did that, so what are you going to do then?
Well, I'm going to put a poached egg on yours to make it extraordinary. I like to, the day after, I like to take the turkey and remove it from the carcass, take all the meat out. So like this, I know what I have for meat left, and break down that carcass, put it in a pot on the fire, add some water, couple bay leaf and thyme, and make a nice little stock. That is a delicious stock to keep in your house for making soup or whatever in the next few days. You can even put it in the freezer and just wait a couple of weeks. So that's one part of the ideas. And the other one is to make a nice little minestrone soup. Start with onions, carrots, celery, all those different ingredients, beans, and then add some of the diced turkey in there as a meat, and some of the leftover kale. I do roasted vegetable for turkey Thanksgiving sides. So I do a whole pan of roasted vegetables. So I add some of those roasted vegetables into the minestrone after everything else is cooked. At the last minute, I dice those turnips, turnips and rutabagas, and they're already roasted. Dice those and put them in the soup with the turkey, and that makes a big batch of soup for the next couple of days in the refrigerator, ready to go with some turkey in it. And that's one way to use your turkey.
Chef, anything from you?
I do three things. I make stock, just like Chef here does, and I break down my bird night of as well, just so it's just one less thing to do. Mm-hmm. I make sandwiches, and I re-crisp my stuffing in the pan before I put it on my sandwich, and then I make turkey tettuccine.
Wait, go back.
Okay.
Go back. You put the stuffing on your sandwich?
I do.
Oh, my God.
Carb on carb is my favorite way to love myself.
I can't believe you just tried to gloss over that.
I know, yeah. It's
so
delicious.
You have a piece of bread, you put turkey on it, and then you pan fry your stuffing and put that on?
Smoosh my stuffing into a little cake and pan fry it till it gets a little bit crispy, and then put that on top of it.
Wow.
I mean, Baker's,
you griddle the whole thing then?
The sandwich itself is not griddled.
But
oh, that's radical.
I know.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay, now you can go ahead.
And then I make turkey tettuccine.
Oh, yeah. Classic.
Classic. Yeah. Little sherry in there. Yeah.
Yeah. Lovely.
That sounds delish.
My go-to when everything is not quite enough is I make hash.
Oh, yeah.
And
yeah.
I just, the stuffing, the mashed potatoes or the sweet potatoes, the turkey, the kale, whatever it is, I just put it all into the hash.
Yeah. Take those green beans, dice them.
And light lots of butter.
Yeah.
And then, of course, I always make a ton of gravy because if I do say so myself, people love my gravy. I'm just saying. The sweet onion gravy.
Do you have anybody who's ever, than you've ever cooked dinner for that said it wasn't good?
So many
besides
people
me?
Swoon for my gravy. I make a great. I'm a gravy master, or some people have said gravy god.
Other people.
I don't like
that.
To throw around the word god very often, but
other people. Yeah.
Maybe gravy god. But the trick to mine is that I soak it in chipotle Tabasco, so that it has a nice kick to it, and then and it's all pan fried and brown and crunchy and delicious, and then the gravy god shows up and. Slathers it with.
There's a picture of you floating around the internet right now of you hitting a pan of gravy with an immersion blender.
Oh, I know. I made that right here in this kitchen.
Doing it right there, and my mouth waters every time I see it. It looks delicious.
Well, that was a young lady who's taught here before, Laura Crotty, and she submitted this to the Huffington Post. And so I said, no problem. I'm happy to do that, blah, blah, blah. And so I do it. I literally make it special for the photograph because I didn't have one from my cookbook that I could use. And then I look at the article and, oh, yeah, it's Tom Douglas and Thomas Keller and some lady
someone
named
else,
Alice Water.
Someone named Alice Water. Some living legend named Alice Water.
It's like, thank you.
Yeah, you're in good company.
For the fancy company. That was pretty awesome. So that was such a. My jaw dropped when I saw that. It's just the three of us.
Yep.
You know me, Thomas Keller, and Alice Waters.
Yeah.
So,
the perfect trio, by the way.
Yeah.
Super fun. We talked about soup, we talked about hash, we talked about potato pancakes. What about the desserts that are left over? Because, frankly, for me, if I don't give them away to the people that left the house, they're in the garbage for me. I'm so sick of them by that point.
Yeah, well, you should talk to my wife because that's not happening.
No, she likes the pumpkin pie in the morning.
She likes the pumpkin pie and the pecan pie. She loves the pecan pie. Yeah. And then, like I said earlier, I was, I don't know if I said this on the show, but I'm every year my duty is to make an apple tart. So I make a frangipani kind of apple tart. And
Did you say frangipani?
Well, frangipani as in
frangipani-ish.
I mix.
Did he say frangipani?
Well, because it's not just frangipani.
That's so un-French of you.
Well, it's yes, it is. I just invented a word, by the way. That's not really a word, but it's a half pastry cream and half frangipani. That's why I call it frangipani.
Okay.
So it's not just one thing. And then I put all my apple right on top. And then usually I try to do like some kind of a Armagnac sorbet. Remember I mentioned I like Armagnac, which is prune. It's not Calvados, but it's I love my Armagnac. So I like to serve a little shot of Armagnac, 15 years old at least, like Sampé, you know, something like that. And serve that on the side as you're eating your apple tart.
I'm going to remind you later at some special date that you said crème anglaise and frangipani. Up next, Brendan Mergel is going to join us. He's going to talk about his new Roman-style pizzeria down there on First Avenue and Marion Street in Seattle. On Cairo Radio, 97.3 FM. All right, we are back in the Seattle kitchen. It's Cairo Radio. My name is Tom Douglas, chef owner of Seattle's several Seattle's fine restaurants. My cohort over there.
Thierry Rotureau, the chef in the hat, owner of two restaurants.
Yeah.
Luc in Madison Valley and Lule downtown Seattle at the Sheraton Grand.
Also our audience motivator, so don't mess up, okay?
I'm trying not to mess up.
We are joined by Chef Brendan Mergel. Brendan is the chef owner of Hitchcock and now the new Bar Taglio. Like the train.
The G is silent like lasagna.
Yes, exactly. A Roman-inspired bar... pizza al taglio. Okay, the mic is all yours. Tell us about it because I haven't been there yet.
All right, so the idea was to have a classy little slice joint downtown, and I didn't know much about New York-style pizza, so I decided Roman-style pizza would be it's a fond memory I had from traveling in Rome. And I shout out to Roman Pizza Academy, Massimiliano Seva and his crew, because I got an excellent study there, certification. And it's just a beautiful spot. We're in the Exchange Building on First and Marion. And so far it's been, lively downtown crowd.
Mm-hmm.
It's right next to our cafe, Hitchcock. So now we've got a little property there.
Fun.
Yeah.
I've known all about that, where you kind of open up next door across the corner.
You gang up.
You gang up.
Yeah. And, it's already showing. The whole corner feels busier. We're achieving some critical mass.
Mm-hmm.
Good for you. That sounds delicious. Well, so what makes tell the listener what makes a Roman pizza a Roman pizza?
Okay, so Roman pizza is more like sourdough bread baking than the Neapolitan pizza that we practiced at Bruciato, our island-based pizzeria, which means that you have a long, high hydration and up to 96-hour fermentation with maybe 92% hydration, extremely high protein flour. That's very special for this process. And then you roll it into these large balls that have a much shorter proofing time than the 3 days we would give a Neapolitan dough ball.
Right.
And then you bake that into a steel pan in a Moretti oven that's unlike our wood-fired pizza ovens that are sort of like this magical dance, with like a gypsy woman, trying to make some magic happen. This is like dialed in, top height versus deck height, mm-hmm. heat, all very specific. And what you get is what we call pizza bianca, which is also known like a focaccia. And then you have 3 days that you can use that finished piece of sourdough bread to top it and bake it and then cut it. Pizza al taglio, Roman-style pizza, is served by the slice. So we do serve whole pies, but it's an assortment of slices, or you can get the whole thing if you want.
Mm-hmm. Is it because it's a little bit heavier or a bit bigger, or is it...
They appear to be heavier and bigger, but they're not because of that superb hydration.
Right.
The idea is that you have an extremely crunchy bottom, and then it has excellent structure from the gluten being so developed, very specific three-phase, two-speed mixer. When we use ice water, so we can just pound it and really develop the gluten, which creates this beautiful structure that, if you do it right, is also still very light, but somehow holds all the toppings.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So for everyone who ever ate at my Neapolitan pizzeria and said, how come it's not crispy? You can say, well, you got to go to the Roman-style pizzeria then. Crisp is your thing.
Well, the most recent one I had was over at Rene Erickson's place over here at the Spheres, right. Downtown Wilmont's Ghost. And what I liked about her style of pizza, and she considers it Roman style also, is that you do get that nice darkness on the bottom of the mm-hmm. crust,
right.
Which to me adds a ton of flavor, right?
Right.
It's something that when I did Sirius pie, which is more Neapolitan in style, but I don't consider it Neapolitan because we do a low and slow bake on it,
yeah,
comparatively low and slow.
Right.
But I liked getting those black boils and that really super brown. Matter of fact, I had so many pizzas sent back when I first opened that everyone wouldn't even try it because they said it was burnt.
They're burnt.
Yeah, I know exactly that. It is its style. We had to blonde it up a little bit just because of that. So.
Well, and I think you set kind of a benchmark for a lot of what people expect for pizza in the Northwest. People would come to Bruciato, which means burnt in Italian.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, does it?
Yeah, when people say, oh, your pizza's burnt, I'm like, exactly. there's a degree to which that's what we're looking for.
Right.
The flame blackened blisters don't happen unless you've done that correctly. Mm-hmm. So,
right.
It's the converse of that Roman style. There we do a very short bulk ferment. And it's maybe like 65% hydration. Mm-hmm. And then the dough balls that we roll, those go into a cold proof for 3 to 4 days.
Yeah, exactly.
Before we proof them to stretch, which is, just, they're smaller balls, so that mm-hmm. might take an hour. So it's just the same process, completely reversed.
So in the Roman style, are the topping similar to the Neapolitan style? Or?
The fun thing about Roman style, and I think we're chasing the dragon of the Gabriele Bonci gold standard of Roman style pizza, modern.
That's
Roman.
A good goal to have.
It is. His example is more like, it's like tartine craft.
Right.
So you can take the pizza bianca and schmear like ricotta or a stracciatella cheese and then put absolutely anything you want on top after right. it comes out of the oven. And this style of toasts that are elaborated. It's very popular right now. We sell more margaritas with the bufala mozzarella and like salami pizza with Calabrian chilies than anything else. But we can also get very creative with mortadella and heirloom chicories from local farms, right. Big raw garnishes. Those are really the ones I go for the most.
Mm-hmm. That's cool.
Yeah,
I can't wait to go try a slice.
You know, in a Naples pizza, you can only put so many toppings on it.
Yeah, usually it's like three
like
topping.
Right.
Three topping is like the maximum.
Yeah, then the whole thing's going to fall apart. And all the topping falls off.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. It's kind of off menu. I think we're going to bring it on for happy hour, but we sell these polpettine, these meatballs. You can load one of these Roman-style pizzas up with meatballs.
So that's why you should have a slice, not a whole pizza.
Yeah, that's right.
Because it's a meal of its own.
It's a staff favorite.
I was in Rome, my favorite one, I mean, you go to all these different pizza shops in Rome, but my favorite was always the potato pizza with rosemary. It's just for some reason, we still have it now at Sirius Pie, completely stolen from some pizzeria I was in 35 years ago in Rome. So, but people are a little weirded out sometimes when they go starch on starch like that.
Right.
So nothing wrong with that.
We sell a lot of potato pizzas, mm-hmm. and we fry the rosemary, and we elaborate it a little bit. Our chef there, Nahum Ochoa, is a fantastic chef who just moved to the region. And so he really wanted to make like very creamy French-style pomme puree mm-hmm. and then top it with fingerlings that we've poached and sliced thin. So it's a little bit of an elaboration.
Mashed potato with potato on top?
Triple starch, right. The carbonara and amatriciana are also fun Roman elaborations. If you've been to Rome, you can't throw a rock without hitting a bistro serving those two pastas.
Right.
And they translate well. And we make our own guanciale from our Mangalitsa hogs off of Shady Acres. So, I feel like it's a pretty special slice once it boils down.
Hmm. So fun. Tell us again where people can get your new Roman-style pizza.
First in Marion in the Exchange Building, Bartaglia right next to Cafe Hitchcock and Cafe Hitchcock Express upstairs.
Cool. I'm going to head down there right after the show.
come on down, guys. We'll have lunch.
I know, exactly. I'm starving to death. Although we do have sandwiches coming
for we do.
Esteemed audience. Up next, we have Brittany Bartleben is going to join us from the Dahlia Bakery. It's really, we're getting down to it when it comes to Thanksgiving dessert, so you better hang out and listen up because she will help you be more successful. Or just go to thedahliabakery.com and buy a pie right there.
Buy your pizza on the way up.
Exactly. You know, this is the first year we're limiting our pies, so you better get your order in there now. Right here on Cairo Radio, 97.3 FM. All right, we're back then. It's the Seattle Kitchen here at the Hot Stove Society. Got two segments left today. Stick with us. Of course, we're going to follow up with the Food for Thought Tasty Trivia Challenge. And we brought one question left over from our questions from our listeners because it was directly related to Miss Chef Bartleben from the Dahlia Bakery, Dahlia Pastry Kitchen.
Yeah, so Sheila Lipinski, who asked that great question about the Pacific Northwest side dishes, mm-hmm. also asked a question. She wanted to know some dessert ideas, but she's not a big fan of pumpkin pie.
Okay. So my guess is she doesn't like the pumpkin. It's not pie in general that she's...
Yeah.
Okay. Well, there's a million things you can have instead of pumpkin pie. You can have apple pie. You can have pecan pie.
Yeah. I've been having Thanksgiving for so many years and never had a pumpkin pie.
I think apple pie is a lovely way to finish Thanksgiving dinner. I also really like the idea of doing just some little nibbles. For instance, what I'll be doing is we've talked about the fruitcake bars, Jackie's fruitcake bars. I will be cutting those very small and serving them with just like good chocolate and some cheese, and that's what I'm serving.
That's kind of interesting.
It's very elegant, isn't it?
So like a little, just a little mini slice.
Cause you've had them; they're rich. I mean, one bar is a commitment. So if you just cut them very thin, it's a wonderful little bite to have with a few pieces of really good chocolate or some cheese and maybe a little Armagnac or something mm-hmm. like that.
I love that.
Yeah, I also love the idea of doing cream puffs as a little. after dinner suite. And we're doing
cream puffs are good anytime.
They're delicious. And I personally absolutely adore the maple cream puffs that we make, which are available in the bakery right now. And so it's a maple pastry cream. And rather than a chocolate glaze, it's a maple glaze. Mm-hmm. And it's just... It's
I know I had one last week.
I figured you're... Yeah. These are kind of your fave, aren't they? Yeah. To me, it's like a maple bar, like everything you like about a paper bar, only just even better because they're creamy. And
I love them when the puff pastry, you serve, I've had the eclair version, same thing, but I love them when the puff pastry, or not, not
the choux,
the pâte à choux is crisp.
Yeah.
So
yep.
even if you have to leave it sit a day or two, I have no problem with that because it gets hard and crunchy and then with that nice thick custard in the center, which reminder that when you have an eclair, the custard's not supposed to drip out, right? It's supposed to be firm and stay with your bite and then the nice glaze on top.
And you could also dunk them like the croquant, you know, you could dunk them in caramel.
And
then put them on a grill to just
Why not?
Dry
it's Thanksgiving.
Out.
Yeah.
It's probably not the time to do profiteroles, though, right? It's too heavy and mushy with frozen ice cream and chocolate sauce.
I mean, for me, no. I have no interest in ice cream at Thanksgiving. I want to sit there and linger over my dessert.
So talking about ice cream, there's plenty of fruits available, you know, quince, pears, apple, huckleberries. Cranberries, you could do so many different little sorbet assortment or ice cream assortment.
A sorbet is a nice, if you are going frozen,
nice
if you're feeling light. Yeah.
So you do sorbet and you just do a little tuile on the side. Mm-hmm. So it's nice and light. You have a nice light finish to your meal. I think it's a great way to do it.
Mm-hmm. Also, one of the pies that was always at the buffet of pies that we had growing up was a lemon meringue pie.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like holidays, everybody wants that. And we actually do a lemon meringue tart. It's got the ratio of meringue to lemon filling is a little more equal. I grew up with the giant mountain of meringue, which is not for me. I always thought I hated lemon meringue pie because of that. But
it turns out
I just hate that much meringue in one bite.
And if you feel so inclined, if you want to work hard, you could do your bars that you were talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, you could do small little meringue lemon pie.
Little tartlets.
Yeah.
Very elegant.
Do you like that? Do you like when you get a little plate of lots of mini desserts?
Yes.
Is that appealing to you?
I adore it. Yeah.
Much more appealing to me than a big slice of pie. Mm. Kind of the same ideas we always talk about the roast beef, you know. I like it to be butterfly, so everything is crunchy and nice and seared and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Same kind of concept for me on anything. I'd rather have three different style of things on the plate in smaller, just in small bite. Versus one big chunk of anything.
It depends on how many people you're serving. If you're serving 12 people, that makes sense. If it's a family of three or four, just make a pie or not pumpkin pie. Uh-huh. But,
What are those little cookies? And you see them sometimes on little cookie, like the free little cookie plates you get at fancy restaurants. And I buy them down at Le Panier Bakery. They're called Friand.
Yeah, Friand.
Well, tell me about
which
that.
Just like, it's just
I
like,
love those things.
It's a basic idea of a frangipane idea, which is basically almond paste.
Mm-hmm.
And it's basic frangipani. And it's almond paste with a little bit of eggs and sugar. And it's mixed into, put into a mold and then baked. It's very... Very simple.
There's no flour in it then?
Not that I know of in the Friand dynamic, no. It's very close to, you know, financier, rich in butter, little eggs, and almond, just ground almond, like an almond flour. And it's very simple to make, very delicious, and it's good with a little booze on top, you know, if you use like a little amaretto or something right on top.
Yeah,
it's
I love
nice.
Those.
Soak them up a little bit.
I always eat one of those or two or three when I'm in line waiting to be served down there. So it's awesome. You make a little crinkle cookie at the bakery that I love, too, and it seems to have a pretty decent shelf life, which is another thing about Thanksgiving, right? You always have leftovers, so you want them to be the kind of food that is actually good the next day or the next 2 days. So
you're talking about the truffle cookie?
Yeah, the little
chocolate truffle cookies, Yeah, those are great. They also freeze really well, too, if you've... Because they're rich. They're kind of a commitment. Mm-hmm. And it's a good portion as well. So I actually love
I'm talking about the little ones, right?
The little mini versions.
Yeah.
So it's the same cookie.
Cookie.
Yeah, we just roll them in powdered sugar so they get sort of a crackly look. But yeah, they are like, we call them the truffle cookie for a reason. They are like a truffle in one bite. It is very rich.
Yeah, and I think chocolate truffle is a great way to finish a meal of any kind, especially a meal like this, because you're not using chocolate anywhere else. Make it very small.
Yeah.
Just a nice little pop of chocolate in your mouth on your way out with an espresso or you know, something like this is really delicious.
Yeah.
One of my favorites that my mom made was, I think she called them pecan sandies.
Oh, I love those. You
know? So yeah. That's one where it's got a little, almost like a little cream cheese crust, mm-hmm. and it's tiny, the size of a, what do I have, a 50-cent piece here?
Mm-hmm.
You don't even know what a 50-cent piece is, do you, Abigail? Mr. Kennedy used to be on those, just a reminder.
I was born yesterday.
Anyway, and then they had like a pecan pie filling in mm-hmm. the middle of it
yeah.
and baked.
Yeah.
I love those.
And that's a great little Thanksgiving treat because, again, pecan pie is rich. It's a commitment. But a little bite, you still get those flavors without, you know, hating yourself mm-hmm. after.
So there are different ways to bake a pie. But apparently, we know the round one. But if you were to do it in a cookie sheet.
Flat
you know,
pie.
Or like yeah. a Pyrex pan. Mm-hmm. You could do it like this, and you could stamp your pie after it's baked into much smaller portion, going back to the smaller sizes, mm-hmm. instead of having a big piece of pie. I know everybody's like, why would you want to cut my pie?
Exactly what I was just thinking.
But the reason is because you're having chocolate truffles, you're
right.
having this. You're making different...
A smorgasbord.
Different, yeah, a smorgasbord mm-hmm. of desserts, mm-hmm. which is a lot bit more fun. Mm-hmm. You could also join in and make a little jam. Then you could put on the side if you were to do, for example, your friand. Mm-hmm. It's always nice to have a little jam with that, like a nice raspberry jam. Those raspberries you picked at the farm in the summertime, you put in your freezer. Like a nice little jam and put that on the side.
Here's a question I have for you, chef, pastry chef Brittany Bartleben. We had a pie fail at our early Thanksgiving at my mom's house this last weekend. And I would say 50% of us didn't like it. The other 50% mm-hmm. thought it was delicious. Too many pecans in the pecan pie.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, no.
So if you had a recipe, I mean, it was so thick with pecans. I just found it unappealing. And a lot of times in my mind, pecan pie, you've got that kind of almost chess pie kind of filling
yes.
with pecans in it,
it's
right?
It's like almost a custard.
But a sugar custard. Corn syrup custard
yes,
or
yes,
whatever.
A yeah. dairy-less custard.
Right. Even, so...
Yeah.
Now you've got a recipe. This recipe had 3 cups of chopped pecans
mm-hmm.
and then the whole pecans on the top. It was a lot of pecans.
That's too much.
Wow. And I
yeah.
just found it unappetizing,
yeah.
overly pecan.
Yeah.
How would you fix that?
I would not put the pecans on top.
But will it affect the filling? Will the filling still set if you don't have as many pecans? Or would you like, have you ever toasted your pecans first?
I definitely toast my, well, I take a page from Stacey Fortner's book. She's our other pastry chef, and she is from Kentucky, brought with her this amazing Kentucky bourbon pecan pie. It is the best pecan pie I've ever had in my life. Somehow it's not too sweet. Her ratio is about 3 cups of pecans.
In total. Okay.
And it's very well toasted pecan halves, not the pieces.
Right.
And toast, like, I'm talking, put them in a low oven mm-hmm. and toast them until just your home is permeated with yeah. the smell of toasted pecans. They're not burnt, but they're yeah. really crunchy. And then, yeah, add that to your pie and then pour your custard, for lack of a better term, over that. And it's the perfect ratio. And then you don't have to sit there and spend the time arranging pecans on top. I've never understood why anybody...
It's pretty.
Don't
be like that.
Pretty,
so negative.
And this is when you also...
Maybe it's because we've made, like, you know, we'll do 1,000 of them.
Yeah.
So the thought of that just sounds horrible.
But that's also when you do a nice little bourbon whipped cream.
Bourbon whipped cream, sure. Yeah.
All right. So just it's okay to take pecans out. It'll still set when you bake it.
It'll still set. Those eggs will do their job.
All right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Up next, it's time for Food for Thought Tasty Trivia. Brittany's going to stay with us, and we're going to be right back on Cairo Radio, 97.3 FM. Welcome back. It's the final segment here on the Seattle Kitchen Show. We're here from the Hot Stove Society. I'm Tom Douglas.
I'm Terry Rogero, the chef in the hat.
And we are joined by Chef Brittany Bartleben from the Dahlia Bakery and Dahlia Lounge. We have invited Mr. Sean to join us on the microphone because I guess we just, you know, you are the voice of Cairo Commercial Radio right now.
You do
all the voiceovers. So we want people to get a familiar voice for their Thanksgiving Food for Thought Tasty Trivia
yep.
Challenge.
I think that was probably the smartest thing you could have done for this show today.
There you go. I would agree with that.
Mr. Humble himself.
Okay, Sean, what do we got? What are the rules here?
Yeah, so as you folks know, I've got 5 questions for each of you. Whoever wins, that's fantastic. But it's better if you lose because then it works out great for one of our audience members. Mm-hmm. And we're going to be playing today for Melissa Henry, who had a question for us earlier in the show, asking what was a great signature Thanksgiving cocktail to serve.
Cool.
So, All right. What do you guys want to give away? Terry, what do you want to give away if you should lose today?
I think I'm going to give lunch for two at Lule.
Tom, what are you going to give away if you should lose?
I'm going to give away a signed copy of Tom's Big Dinners, because on the top of that book, we have a big celebratory picture of us having Christmas Eve, but reminds me of Thanksgiving also. It's the holiday season. Along with a signed Seattle Kitchen Radio Show apron. Both Chef Terry and I have signed
it. Wait, those are priceless.
They're priceless. Jeez. We might even get Chef Bart Laban to put her signature on.
Ooh, I love.
Yeah. All right.
So that'll be going out to the winner.
All right, sounds good. And Brittany, what about yourself?
I'll do a $100 gift card to the Dahlia Bakery.
Okay.
Yeah.
Ooh, right on.
Valuable this time of year.
Yeah, valuable. Definitely, right. Come check out our holiday menu.
That's one quarter of a coconut cream pie.
It's a slice.
All right. Are we all set now?
Yep.
All right, Terry, you want to go first?
Sure.
All right, here we go. Which of the following bread does not utilize the sponge method of baking? Is it pita, chatoran, Portuguese sweetbread, or brioche?
I'm going to go with the last one you said.
It is not brioche. It is pita.
Oh, I thought... Yes, that is correct. I was wrong.
Okay. Second one for you, Terry. According to the FDA, which of the following varieties of chocolate must specifically contain at least 15% chocolate liquor? Is it white chocolate, bittersweet chocolate, milk chocolate, or dark chocolate?
I'm going to go with the bittersweet chocolate.
Incorrect. That would be milk chocolate.
Yeah, that too. Both of them.
All right.
Zero for two.
That's right. Okay, number three for you. If you were to see kefir on a menu, what would you be ordering? A paste made from preserves of stone fruit and pistachios, a flatbread made of chickpea flour, or a sauce created out of preserved lemons, onions, and a collection of spices, or a fermented milk drink?
What's the first? How did you spell that name?
K-E-F-I-R.
Kefir. That's a limey. So I'm going to go with the last one, the infusion, the drink.
Fermented milk?
Yes.
That's correct.
Correct. That's what I meant to say.
Oh!
Thank you. Finally got one.
Right.
Jesus.
Yeah. That was a pity clap if ever I heard
one.
Oh,
yeah, I know. I was like, does yes or no?
Okay, Terry, this is a true or false. The Guji berry is also known as foxberry.
Correct.
Terry, you are wrong. It is false.
Yeah, well, of course. If I say yes, it's no, so it's no.
All right. One more for you, Terry. The Chilean sea bass is a rebranding of what fish due to its unappealing name? The Antarctic char, the Patagonian toothfish?
Yes.
That's correct. There you go.
2 for 5. Ay, ay, ay.
Okay.
Not a great show. Brittany, you're going to be good on
we'll
this
see.
One.
See.
All right. Brittany, do you want to go next?
I'll go next.
Okay. Which of the following varieties of seaweed is not edible? Wakame, Irish moss, kombu, or turtle weed? It seems you're familiar with all of them.
So I work with them all the time.
Yeah.
Let's go the second one.
No, it was turtle weed.
Okay.
Yeah.
I was going to say that.
Okay. Question number two for you, Brittany. The term for Greek yogurt that has had additional whey strained from it and used as a spread is labané, korma, halva, or amnali?
Labané.
Yes, that is correct. And nice pronunciation, too.
Sometimes referred to as Greek yogurt cheese.
Yep.
Question number three, Brittany, which of the following is not one of the six noble grapes in winemaking? Pinot Noir, Pinot Gris, Riesling, or Merlot?
Merlot.
Incorrect. It would be Pinot Gris.
All right.
All right. We've got one correct, two wrong.
Looks like we're not throwing each other here.
Okay.
Come on, Brittany. You can do this.
Brittany, this is a true or false. All of the following fruits are berries. Blueberries, blackberries, raspberries, and strawberries. True or false?
That's false.
That is false.
Yes.
Strawberries.
Raspberries and blackberries are technically stone fruits.
This is your last question. If you are looking to add an earthy element to a dish via a smoker, which of the following woods would you use? Mulberry, alder, mesquite, or walnut?
That is a goofy question, too. I like it, though. It's like when it's
an
not mine.
An earthy quality.
Yeah, an earthy element to a dish via a smoker. Mulberry, alder, mesquite, or walnut?
The second one.
No, mesquite.
Mesquite.
Yeah. No, that's the third one.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Oh, did
no,
you mean that
the
one?
Third
sure.
One.
Yeah. There you go. You got it.
Yeah.
Nice job.
All right, that's three. You got three right. So far,
yes,
you're
pick one.
You're winning against Terry so far.
All right.
So now here comes the gravy god, Tom Douglas.
I'm just saying some people call me that.
Right.
I'm a person.
I'm some.
I'm a person.
Yes,
and
you,
I'm some.
Yes, you are. Okay. Tom, number one, if you prepare meat using the red cooking method, what are you doing to the meat? Is it topping meatloaf with ketchup before baking it in the oven? Slow cooking the meat, then browning it in soy sauce over a considerable time? Taking any red meat to just rare? Brining red meat in white wine before braising it with a full-bodied red?
Wait.
That's a lot of words.
I've never heard of any of those.
Wait.
I think I dozed off.
The last
off.
One you said, braising in white wine with some red wine? What's that about?
Brining the red meat in white wine before braising it with a full-bodied red.
Oh. Who's ever heard of that? Whatever. That's definitely number three.
I say all four.
Yeah.
No, I'm gonna go with the meatloaf with ketchup because that just brings lots of memories.
Okay. Unfortunately, it is B, slow cooking the meat, then browning it in soy sauce.
Ah, that's called redding the meat?
Red cooking method.
Oh, so you're talking about the Korean style or Chinese style of pork.
Yeah, I suppose so.
Okay.
According to the USDA, what is the appropriate internal temperature for a medium rare piece of beef?
130.
Yeah. Yep, you got it.
According to Chef Terry, 105.
If it's still running, it's better.
And number three for you, Tom. True or false, buttermilk can be made using a ratio of 1 cup of milk and 1 tablespoon of lemon juice or vinegar.
Well, there's a difference between that with being sour milk and buttermilk. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if they're confused or if they don't know better.
Right.
But I'm going to say yes because I think that's what they want.
There you go. You got it. All right. And number four, Tom, when a green bell pepper turns red, what is happening to the pepper?
It's ripening.
Yeah, reach maturity. Mm-hmm. There you go. Mm-hmm. Good job. All right, one more for you. You've got four correct.
Three.
Three.
Oh, three?
Wow, these guys are competitive.
Oh.
I would never be that competitive.
All right.
We're just on top of it.
They're not counting or anything.
No, not at all.
I'm mucking everyone.
Okay. A loofah is not just a sponge, but it is also a Swedish holiday pastry made with honey and berries, an Arctic pear, a malted rice wine with allspice and hot peppers, or a tropical cucumber.
I go with number one.
No.
Swedish holiday pastry.
A tropical cucumber.
Oh, see?
Yeah.
Who knew?
So I guess
you did.
Got two wrong then,
yes,
right, everyone?
Yes.
Yep. Well, you guys are tied at three, but
so
you're winning.
So that makes Chef Thierry the loser.
So Melissa is going to lunch at Lule.
Absolutely, and they're a winner. If you want to be part of the show, you just got to go to hotstovesociety.com and buy a ticket for $20. Comes with breakfast and hot coffee. Was it worth it?
Yes.
Yay! The show is produced by our friends at Large Media. That's LARJ Media. And our sound engineer and quiz questioner, Sean, don't call me Del Torre. Also, remember, if you miss any episode of Seattle Kitchen on Cairo 97.3 FM, you can listen via podcast. Just subscribe to Seattle Kitchen on your favorite podcast app.
Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.